This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents The Death of WCW, written by R.D. Reynolds and Brian Alvarez. Performed by Brian Alvarez.
To Dixie and Bob. Forward. 10 years ago, when the original edition of this book was released, World Championship Wrestling had just closed up its doors 3 years earlier. That company's demise ended a legacy that stretched back to the days of territorial pro wrestling, with promoters like Paul Jones in Atlanta and Jim Crockett Sr. in Charlotte, dating back to the Depression. The pro wrestling industry was territorial in nature prior to 1984, when things started to change with the advent of cable television. What's notable is that many of the same opportunities arose in the late 1940s and early 1950s, when the birth of network television garnered the major promotion's national primetime exposure. The mentality in that era was that the dozens of wrestling companies would work together. The promoters who had national television had a key to the gold mine and would utilize that exposure to broker their top stars to the local promoters for a nice booking fee, usually based on a cut of the gate. This led to thriving promotions all over North America and in many other parts of the world. The National Wrestling Alliance is a name that dates to about 1940, originally used by a promotion based in Kansas City. But the famous NWA, the one that led to the creation of the titular WCW, was a conglomerate of regional promotions that dated back to meetings in 1948. By the 1950s, they had set up an arguably illegal monopoly of the business, one so overarching that it even led to a Justice Department investigation. The various promoters would respect territorial boundaries. If an outside promoter came along, the alliance could help in many ways, such as send top talent to the promoter in a jam. They could also go with a more heavy-handed approach, such as threaten to blacklist talent that appeared for a non-NWA member. A key rule was that an NWA promoter could only recognize the NWA world champion voted by the board of directors at the annual conventions. For most of the 1950s, the NWA was the dominant force in pro wrestling. But there was always opposition. Leading promoters who couldn't get along or simply didn't want to get along. In 1957, when the Alliance champion, Lou Thesz, quit to wrestle overseas, he handpicked his replacement in Dick Hutton, one of the greatest U.S. amateur heavyweights in history. But while Hutton was top of the line as a real wrestler, he wasn't particularly colorful and couldn't draw like Thesz. A number of promoters decided he wasn't worth the 13% of the gate booking fee that the Alliance charged, 10% of the champion, and 3% of the Alliance itself. Over the next several years, the Alliance nearly crumbled. New major champions were created. The World Wrestling Alliance was based in Los Angeles, and its champion was recognized in Japan, where wrestling was on highly rated primetime network television, although it rejoined the NWA in 1968. The American Wrestling Association was based in Minneapolis, as another former amateur star, Vern Gagne, who for political reasons never had a shot at the NWA title, bought controlling interest in the promotion and made himself AWA champion. But Gagne always worked harmoniously with the NWA, except for a brief period in the late 1960s when he arrived in Los Angeles. But bigger problems were coming. In 1962, the NWA champion was Nature Boy Buddy Rogers, who was being booked by Northeast promoter Vincent James McMahon, the father of today's Vincent Kennedy McMahon. McMahon kept the champion working in the Northeast the majority of every month. While the NWA's strongest cities, like St. Louis and Toronto, got steady championship matches, smaller territories weren't getting dates on Rogers. This led to more promoters creating their own champion. A showdown was about to take place. In late 1962, Sam Muchnick, who headed the NWA, scheduled Thesz to beat Rogers for the title. Things got hairy, as strange things began to happen, such as convenient injuries by Rogers. This led to the match continually being delayed. D-Day came on January 24, 1963, in Toronto. In the ring, Thesz, one of the great legitimate submission wrestlers of the era, told Rogers, quote, "We could do this the hard way or the easy way," a line that had already become part of pro wrestling's lexicon from Thez's mentor, Ed Strangler Lewis. It remains used to this day in the business, kept alive in modern interviews by Stephanie McMahon. The fallout was McMahon's champion lost, but McMahon wanted no part of Thez as champion. Thez never drew well in his cities, and Rogers, in 1962, was the hottest thing going. Originally, McMahon tried to pretend the Thez-Rogers match never happened, still billing Rogers as champion. When that became impossible, he announced that Rogers had won a tournament in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, to become the Worldwide Wrestling Federation champion. In 1979, the WWWF was shortened to WWF, as in World Wrestling Federation. Today, the promotion is known as World Wrestling Entertainment, or WWE for short. McMahon and Muchnick still worked together, and in 1965 decided to unify the titles. McMahon's new champion, Bruno Sammartino, was to beat Thez, and they'd work out the dates. But for a number of reasons, the deal the promoters worked out fell through, as Sammartino refused a schedule that would have him on the road every single day. Ironically, Thez wasn't happy with the arrangement either. In 1971, McMahon rejoined the NWA, and the WWWF World Heavyweight title, as it was called during the first Sammartino reign that lasted from 1963 to 1971, was simply called the WWWF title. It was never really known to fans that the WWWF had rejoined the NWA, nor that McMahon had influence on picking the NWA champion. By the late 1970s, cable television emerged and would change the game. Jim Barnett, who ran the Georgia office, was the first beneficiary. It was almost a fluke. The local Channel 17 in Atlanta broadcasted highly rated Georgia Championship Wrestling every Saturday and Sunday. As cable companies around the country started picking up the station, first called WTBS and then just TBS, wrestling was its most popular program. The stars on the station started to develop a national following. Barnett had been around pro wrestling since the 1950s, and even though for years he was not allowed to be an NWA member because he was gay, he was eventually brought into the fold. He refused to expand against his fellow promoters, even though he had the capability due to the exposure. In 1982, Vincent James McMahon sold his Northeastern promotion to his 36-year-old son in a complicated business deal, where Vincent Kennedy McMahon used the old company's money to make his payments to the old owner. By this point, the territorial foundation began a full collapse. Gagne had expanded the AWA into San Francisco, causing promoter Roy Shire to retire rather than fight. Barnett was forced out of Georgia, accused of embezzlement, where longtime booker and star heel Ole Anderson, Alan Rogowski, took charge and started moving into new regions. But the most ambitious of all was McMahon, who started running first in Los Angeles. Wrestling changed in 1984, when McMahon signed Gagne's biggest star, Hulk Hogan, and started buying television time all over North America. He bought some companies and took the biggest names away from the other territories. He also hired Barnett as his director of operations. The whirlwind really began to spin during this period. In a secret meeting, unbeknownst to Anderson, McMahon was able to purchase more than 50% of the stock of Georgia Championship Wrestling. This gave him the television contract on TBS and the traditional time slots of the most widely viewed pro wrestling shows in the country. While the relationship only lasted 1 year, it was key to what happened next. TBS was owned by Ted Turner. When Turner put Channel 17 on satellite, he was a laughingstock in television. Seriously, who could possibly want to see an Atlanta UHF station in Los Angeles or Dallas or New York? But he had three very unique ingredients that made it a success, the first being Atlanta Braves baseball and the second being the Andy Griffith Show, television staple a generation earlier. But the third was the most popular of all, pro wrestling, every Saturday and Sunday. In 1981, his two-hour Saturday at 6:05 p.m. wrestling show did a 6.4 average rating for the year. His Sunday show, starting at the same time, did a 6.6. Nothing else in cable came close. Wrestling was the first star of cable television, not unlike it was during the early days of television itself. In 1984, when McMahon purchased the company that had the TBS contract, he first came across Turner. It wasn't pleasant. McMahon had spent $750,000 to get the time slot, which at the time was significant money to him. But Turner got so many complaints from wrestling fans about not getting their Georgia wrestling with popular announcer Gordon Solie that he gave Anderson an earlier hour on his station. Later, he gave Mid-South Wrestling an hour and wanted to get into the wrestling business with Bill Watts. In an embarrassment to McMahon, the small group that taped TV at a boys' club in Shreveport, Louisiana, drew more than a full point higher in the ratings in a non-traditional time slot. Turner attempted to kick McMahon off, noting that ratings were falling and McMahon wasn't producing a show at his studio. In 1985, McMahon sold the rights to the station to Jim Crockett Jr., whose Charlotte-based promotion had become the second strongest in the country, behind stars like Dusty Rhodes, Ric Flair, the Road Warriors, Wahoo McDaniel, and others. Eventually, Crockett, whose father became wealthy promoting wrestling and everything else imaginable in the Carolinas, became McMahon's key opposition. He took over in Georgia, Florida, and the NWA changed from a group of promotions working together to almost synonymous, in the fans' eyes, with Crockett Promotions. Most companies faded away. In 1987, Crockett Jr. bought Mid-South Wrestling from Watts, who was losing too much money trying to be a third national group. The game changed in 1984, when McMahon started buying television time slots. As an example, he offered the television station in San Francisco that had been airing Gagne's show approximately $2,500 per week and a percentage of every house show in the market. Soon, instead of stations airing wrestling as low-cost programming that drew ratings, it was viewed like the Sunday morning religious programming and was the predecessor to infomercial time. Television realized they were in the driver's seat. Without them, there was no local wrestling. So, they started charging local promotions. This sped up the inevitable decline of those companies who couldn't generate enough money to pay for their TV time. This was a major reason why ECW folded as well, as they simply couldn't generate the amount of money needed to pay their television bills. Both Watts, who paid to establish national syndication, and Crockett, who bought out Watts largely to get his network, ended up deep in debt with the new changed business. McMahon, through opening up merchandise, pay-per-view, and doing strong arena business behind Hulk Hogan, had remained profitable through all of this. In late 1988, Crockett was out of cash and sold his promotion to Turner Broadcasting. Ted Turner was in the wrestling business and was McMahon's only real adversary. Though Turner's company struggled in its early years, the cable ratings for the WWF and WCW, as Turner's company became known, were not that different. Wrestling fans would watch wrestling on television and weren't loyal to a particular promotion as far as TV viewing went, as would be the case in another generation. McMahon's company always had an edge with kids and was stronger at the arenas and on pay-per-view. In 1993, things again began to shift as Hulk Hogan quit the WWF after feeling insulted that he was asked to lose the championship to Bret Hart. Business was in a tailspin, so he left to pursue acting, including a television series called Thunder in Paradise. The show was being taped out of Orlando, Florida, where WCW was also taping. By this time, after going through one failed manager after another, WCW was in the hands of Eric Bischoff. Bischoff, and one of WCW's top stars, Flair, talked Hogan into returning to wrestling in 1994, but with them, based on what was an incredible contract for the time. Hogan was such a star that pay-per-view business grew significantly. However, Turner was not satisfied and wanted to know why WCW wasn't beating WWF. Bischoff said it was because WWF had a Monday night primetime show on USA. So Turner gave Bischoff a Monday night show, and the war was on. That led to the most exciting period in television wrestling history. Nitro expanded to 2 hours. Then Raw expanded. Monday night wrestling viewership grew from about 4 million in 1995 to consistently topping 10 million a few years later, peaking at 12 million in 1998 when both companies were strong. The money-losing WCW was suddenly very profitable and blew past WWF in popularity for a short period of time. It was an amazing time to be a wrestling fan. But as quick as it rose, everything collapsed, as WCW never planned for the future. WCW started struggling, as Steve Austin caught fire for McMahon. Infighting was rampant in the company, as fingers were pointed in every direction, leading to creative in 1999 and 2000 possibly being the worst in the history of pro wrestling. They had completely lost touch with their audience, which eroded away at a rate never seen before or since. Since WCW folded, many of those who were in charge have created a number of narratives for why it failed. WCW, at its zenith, was the hottest pro wrestling company the world had ever seen. It had more talent than any company in history. A pro wrestling company as part of the Turner family was a panacea. At one point, they had Vince McMahon on the ropes. But they never planned for the future, and in desperation, the television and arena product got worse and worse. This book explains, sometimes on a week-to-week basis, what built WCW into the most successful pro wrestling company in history, only to be squandered all away. It's a story of how that bright future was basically destroyed in one horrible calendar year, and why, just over 1 year after that, it was gone. 10 years ago, we wrote in the original book that pro wrestling may never be the same because of it. With the benefit of a decade of hindsight, that is no longer speculative. Today's WWE is a stable business, which, through technological changes, has remained profitable for the most part. The big change from a business standpoint is that, unlike in the 80s when McMahon led the way in television stations wanting money to put pro wrestling on the air, the plethora of cable stations hungry for anything that will deliver ratings has made wrestling, or as McMahon now calls it, sports entertainment, into a product that gets paid nine figures annually by NBC Universal through rights fees each year. As screwed up as WCW was, had it survived 5 more years, it would have benefited from the changing economy. In the creative state of 1999 and 2000, that wouldn't have been enough. But in the right hands, the company may never have died. And if it didn't, it may have even thrived economically. But now, the costs of getting in, starting up, and competing with WWE are too high. A generation only knows one major league version of wrestling, and that is WWE. The vast majority of fans aren't open to an alternative. And it certainly doesn't help that the largest alternative, TNA Impact, has been run nearly as ineptly for most of its existence as WCW was during its dying days. WCW always had a traditional fan base dating from the territory days. For the most part, when Nitro was canceled that one fateful night in March of 2001, they quickly drifted away and never came back. There are so many lessons to be learned from WCW's downfall that you would need a book to detail them all. This is that book. It's a book that everyone in wrestling, even those who lived through the famed Monday Night Wars, should read to learn from those mistakes. Dave Meltzer, October 2014. First Edition Forward. When the ultimate history of American pro wrestling is written, there is probably no story more important, with the exception of the history of Vince McMahon Jr. and the World Wrestling Federation, than that of World Championship Wrestling. It is a story about what should have been. WCW was, at its zenith, the single hottest company the wrestling world had ever seen, a title it should have held for years. The idea of a pro wrestling company being part of the Turner family was a panacea. Wrestling had, in most parts of the country, been a hand-to-mouth business. In many parts of the country, it was a huge TV rating success, and many cities had traditions of drawing good crowds on a regular basis. But every place had its ups and downs. Many formerly flourishing cities over the years, from Detroit to San Francisco to Los Angeles to Atlanta to Toronto to Montreal to St. Louis, had great long-standing traditions. In all cases, however, they went down the tubes in very quick order. That was the nature of the beast. But being under the Turner umbrella could have, and arguably should have, changed everything. The backing of a billion-dollar company should not only have opened the doors to better marketing, but also, in theory, have created a promotional synergy that would have put the company on the entertainment map that its rival, McMahon's WWF, had been on since 1984. But to those in charge of the wrestling end of things, it was questionable whether anyone in the Turner regime had a single clue what promoting professional wrestling was all about. Indeed, by the time Ted Turner suggested putting Nitro head-to-head with the WWF's flagship program Raw on Monday nights, pro wrestling in North America was in a terrible depression. The thought of splintering the audience between the two promotions was seen by many in the wrestling business as suicide. Instead, something amazing happened. Raw and Nitro didn't split a finite group of wrestling fans, but instead spent the next several years creating millions and millions of new viewers. The Monday Night Wrestling audience grew from about 4 million in 1995 to more than 12 million at its peak in 1998. When both companies were on a roll. And make no mistake about it, WCW was on one hell of a roll. It went from being a company that no one had much interest in to being the most powerful company in the history of wrestling, one capable of drawing 30,000 people to major stadiums without even having to advertise one match. The man behind WCW's rise to fame was Eric Bischoff, who raised the stakes by paying top dollar and getting the most marketable talent in the world. He brought fans big-name stars and filled the undercards with the best wrestling anywhere. He brought in big-name celebrities, many of whom actually drew money for the company. But Bischoff's biggest contribution was probably the fact that, under him, WCW modernized the in-ring style of American pro wrestling, a style that had languished behind those of both Mexico and Japan for years. Other promotions, such as Paul Heyman's Extreme Championship Wrestling, tried to do the same, but they never had the money to keep the talent they were developing, and they were doomed when WCW started copying their style. Even the mighty WWF didn't have the star power or the talent depth, and its big man style suddenly looked slow and outdated compared to the far more athletic product WCW featured at the time. The irony of Bischoff being the man who did all of this was nothing short of amazing. Prior to his rise up the ranks, Bischoff was little more than a backup announcer, hired largely because he wasn't very good and thus would never be a threat to lead announcer Jim Ross. He grew frustrated at how badly the company was run, and he somehow leapfrogged over everyone to gain control over a business of which he had limited knowledge. His battle plan was really not all that different from McMahon's years earlier. That is, he would spend huge money for the top talent and raid the opposition. McMahon did this in 1984, and his rival promoters laughed at him for overspending. But it was McMahon who had the last laugh, as those promoters quickly went bankrupt while he became the most successful wrestling promoter who ever lived. In the mid-1990s, Bischoff gave McMahon a taste of the medicine he had given the rest of the wrestling world. The end result should have been the same, except, in the end, Bischoff didn't understand his fan base. Perhaps even more crippling was the fact he was so close with pro wrestling's ultimate charmer, Hulk Hogan, that he thought he'd never have to worry. Bischoff really believed that Hogan was pro wrestling, because for so many years, he had been. In addition to Hogan, Bischoff also had every other huge star under contract. Roddy Piper, Randy Savage, Ric Flair, and countless others. Hogan's initial matches with all of these men were huge hits and cast the die for years to come. The problem was that, after years of seeing the same men in the main events, fans yearned for something new. What Bischoff and WCW were presenting became very stale. This wasn't the same as the Rolling Stones doing a tour every few years. This was the wrestling legends of the 80s attempting to dominate television shows in 1999. It wasn't only Bischoff's lack of foresight that led to the company's downfall. The wrestlers themselves took advantage of and ruined the greatest system they could have ever possibly worked under. Bischoff would often allow these men to have total control of their careers, although he'd learn, only not soon enough, that putting old wrestlers in charge of a business that had changed rapidly, but that they still thought was the same as it had been in 1991, was a recipe for disaster. WCW had squandered its future because the hungry younger wrestlers were not allowed into the main events. The guys in those spots jealously guarded them, ran them down to management, and soon all the fresh young stars began to hate their jobs and sought employment elsewhere. Before long, every advantage WCW had was gone, and its future was mortgaged at the feet of the older wrestlers. It would never get that bright future back. In the end, WCW was a victim of its own success. Bischoff had created a successful formula, one that he held on for far too long, and one that ultimately started the downfall of the company. Once the snowball started to roll, those in charge had no idea how to stop it. This book explains, sometimes on a week-to-week basis, how the company was built into the most successful pro wrestling promotion in history, only to be squandered all away. It's a story of how a bright future was basically destroyed in one horrible calendar year, and why, just over 1 year after that, it was gone. Sadly, pro wrestling may never be the same for it. There are so many lessons to be learned from WCW's downfall that you would need a book to detail them all. Thankfully, the book has finally been written. It is a book that everyone in wrestling, even though most lived through it, really need to read in order to remember the mistakes and avoid repeating them. Because sadly, since the death of WCW, we've seen far more examples of copying what killed it than of copying what made it successful. Dave Meltzer, August 2004. Preface. Since the original version of The Death of WCW was released, we have received countless emails and death threats. Thankfully, the former greatly outnumber the latter, and for that, we say thank you. What may have shocked us most during the last decade is yet our lack of correspondence regarding our original dedication. It simply read, to Hunter and Steph. We thought that was a fairly clever, if somewhat subtle, way to begin the proceedings back in 2004. Perhaps it was a bit too subtle. In short, yes, we were referencing Paul and Stephanie Levesque. That would be Triple H and Stephanie McMahon, the heirs apparent to Vince McMahon's cash cow known as World Wrestling Entertainment. In fact, the original layout of The Death of WCW was that of a handbook, a guide, stating everything that a wrestling company could possibly do wrong, using WCW illustrations to prove the points. We thought if we penned a guideline of the exact items that killed WCW, it would guide future wrestling promoters and help them out. Of course, the layout of the book changed because, honestly, the original concept was kind of a mess and not very fun to read. Still, the basic issues that destroyed the company all made it in there. Make no mistake, we knew neither Hunter nor Steph would ever actually read the book. Still, we had hopes that someone within that company might, and perhaps, somehow, in some way, derive some wisdom from it that would help their company as Vince McMahon morphed into Rich Uncle Pennybags, having vanquished all realistic opposition in the pro wrestling industry. The past 10 years have shown us that didn't happen. While we are certain there are people within WWE who have read the book, they have taught those in charge very little about the demise of their largest competitor. Since 2004, WWE has made many, many of the same mistakes that led to WCW's downfall. Granted, there's been nowhere near the level of stupidity that we saw in Ted Turner's Wrastlin' Company, and honest to God, after reviewing and expanding the WCW 2000 chapter, that would be impossible. But still, lessons were there to be learned and were simply ignored. Due to ignoring the past, money has been lost. Money that will never be recovered. In short, they should have read the book, and not just because we dedicated it to them. But it's not just WWE. Amazingly, and most bafflingly, consider the fact that those who were at the helm of WCW during its colossal collapse have found new jobs. In the wrestling business, no less. Why wrestling companies would want to hitch their wagons to the horses that pulled WCW off a cliff is, quite frankly, baffling. A question that can never be answered. But that hasn't changed the fact that those in charge of TNA Impact Wrestling have decided to do just that. Whenever ECW Press calls us to ask what book we are going to write next, the answer is always the same. The Death of TNA. You could just change the letters WCW on the cover to TNA and reprint the rest. Oh, and don't forget to send us our royalty checks. Seriously, look at the front cover of the original Death of WCW. Who do you see? Vince Russo, Eric Bischoff, Hulk Hogan, Scott Hall, and Kevin Nash. Who has been the head writer for TNA during the bulk of its existence? Russo. Who, when they saw that that wasn't working out, did they throw money at to come in and write the ship? Hogan and Bischoff. And what has the company garnered from Russo, Bischoff, and Hogan's years of said guidance? The same issues WCW had and the same result. Losses of millions of dollars. All of that plus a never-ending string of 1.1 television ratings and a whole heap and helping of stupidity that was so plentiful, we decided to add in a listing of it at the end of this book. However, as we're sure they won't bother to learn from history either, we're going to try to go one step further and note the same mistakes both WWE and TNA have made that WCW did years prior. To be sure that no one can miss this, we are not so subtly tagging these sections with bold lessons not learned. We've also added a ton of quotes from those who saw WCW implode just to shut up all the people who mistakenly thought we wrote about what happened without knowing folks behind the scenes. Additionally, you'll find other items and notes that weren't in the original version of the book. Finally, and most importantly, we're changing our dedication. Instead of to Hunter and Steph, this book will be dedicated to Dixie and Bob. Why we bother? We don't know. It's apparent that those in the wrestling business will never learn from the past. We do, however, hold out hope that one day we, the authors of this book, will learn a lesson. Perhaps when the 20th anniversary edition of this book is digitally uploaded directly into your brain, we'll get smart and dedicate it to our wives and kids instead. Introduction. Here lies World Championship Wrestling, 1988 to 2001. World Championship Wrestling was not supposed to die. Anyone with even a basic understanding of its inner workings knew this to be true. As the company began to hit its peak around 1997, all signs indicated that WCW was destined to thrive and prosper. The promotion had so many unfair advantages, it seemed that not only would it continue to expand its profits, but it would also eventually turn every other wrestling promotion in the country into dust. And why wouldn't it? More importantly, how couldn't it? The promotion had the single greatest array of talent the wrestling world had ever known. The two men who defined professional wrestling in the 1980s, Hulk Hogan and Ric Flair, both made their home in WCW. The most popular wrestlers of the 1990s, including Sting and Bret Hart, competed in WCW rings, as did Scott Hall and Kevin Nash, who revolutionized the business as the Outsiders, and shortly thereafter formed the nucleus of the infamous New World Order. The company had the most talented in-ring workers, men like Chris Benoit, Eddie Guerrero, and Dean Malenko, as well as the greatest high flyers from around the world, Rey Mysterio Jr., Juventud Guerrera, and countless others. And perhaps above all, WCW also employed the man who would lead the industry into the next millennium, the man fans flocked to arenas to see, Bill Goldberg. Such a roster of talent had never been seen in a single pro wrestling promotion before. When their flagship show, WCW Monday Nitro, was created, many older fans returned to watch the stars they'd grown up on, creating the largest wrestling audience the cable industry had ever seen. WCW was in a place no company had been since Vince McMahon took the World Wrestling Federation national in the mid-1980s. That is, poised to kill the WWF once and for all. Many wrestlers were eager to jump ship to WCW, some looking to increase their paydays, others out of fear that the WWF wasn't long for this world. Essentially, they were looking to survive. WCW was looking beyond that. Nitro had surpassed not only Raw in the ratings, but every other program on cable television. They weren't just the number one wrestling show, they were the number one cable show, period. Every week, Nitro presented 3 hours of live action, featuring cutting-edge storylines, amazing matches, and production values the likes of which the wrestling world had never seen before. In addition to the skyrocketing ratings, WCW was one of the biggest and most profitable touring groups in the country, as fans swarmed to arenas for live Nitros and for the monthly mega shows. Fans who couldn't attend the matches live ordered in record numbers via the miracle of pay-per-view, spending upwards of $30 a month just to watch the special events. And let's not forget the insane amounts of merchandise sold, from t-shirts to posters to magazines to bandanas to wrestling teddy bears to keychains to beanie babies to sipper cups to every stupid tchotchke piece of crap imaginable. All with the WCW logo slapped right on it. Everything was making the company money, to the tune of more than a $55 million profit in a single year. So let's restate once more for the record that WCW was not supposed to die. In fact, not only was WCW never supposed to vanish from the face of the earth, but the mere thought that the company could ever perish was laughable. How could this company go the way of the dodo? WCW zealots would tell you, inaccurately, but that's beside the point, that it had been around for over 100 years. 100 years! Not only had it been around longer than any other wrestling company, they'd insist, but also longer than almost any other viable form of entertainment. It had been around longer than movies or television. It had been around longer than the National Football League. By God, WCW wasn't just a wrestling company. It was an American institution. As impressive as it was that the company could trace its roots back, quote, nearly to the days of Abraham Lincoln, more impressive was the fact that it was owned by the biggest media mogul in the entire universe, Ted Turner, the real reason why the company could not, would not die. There was simply too damn much money behind it. Turner had purchased the company in the late 1980s almost as a toy, a hobby. And, if truth be told, he wasn't greatly concerned if the thing ever made a dime. Anything it lost was just pocket change, and anything it made likely was as well. But since wrestling had been a cornerstone of the Turner network since the launch of the Superstation, he pledged to keep it around no matter what. So, he had their shows airing on his networks, TBS and TNT, and in prime viewing hours. Monday nights, Wednesday nights, Saturday nights, and Sunday nights. Think about that. In any given week, more often than not, WCW was being featured on the Turner networks during primetime. If another time slot was needed for a new show, or perhaps a bi-monthly special, Uncle Ted was just a phone call away. Backed with the power of the Turner networks, promotion of the pay-per-view events was nothing short of grandiose. How on earth could anyone imagine that World Championship Wrestling might die? After all, if the company was going to die, it would have done so years before it ever hit it big. WCW would have died in 1993, when it lost $6 million filming expensive promotional movies featuring exploding boats and one-eyed midgets. It would have died when it lost its number one draw, Ric Flair, to the competition. It would have, and perhaps it should have, but it didn't. World Championship Wrestling didn't die. In fact, it laughed in the face of death and came out smiling, making more money in 1998, over $50 million, than it had lost in all its previous years put together. WCW wasn't dying. It was growing and expanding, becoming the wrestling company against which all other wrestling companies would ever be measured. WCW was the benchmark of success in the wrestling industry. Fans knew it. The wrestlers knew it. Even the WWF and Vince McMahon knew it. WCW was so successful, in fact, that it didn't matter what stupid mistakes were made because the revenue would always keep coming in. The ratings that came in on Tuesday mornings would justify whatever they did, as would the incredible buy rates and live attendance figures. Yes, WCW was on top, and it knew just how to stay there. By never changing anything. After all, why shuffle the card around in order to give new talent a chance on top? The stars that it had been using for years, the Hogans and the Nashes and the rest, well, they'd been stars for years, and they'd certainly be on top for many more to come. Sure, there were younger and arguably more talented guys on the roster, but they weren't proven commodities. The fans couldn't buy these guys as main eventers. After all, these wrestlers had never been put in such an important position before, and who knew if they could handle the pressure? Besides, Hogan and Nash were the big stars in the eyes of the fans. If anyone tried to convince the WCW brass otherwise, these two wrestlers would be more than happy to explain their role in bringing WCW out of the Dark Ages and into its rightful position as the number one wrestling company on the planet. Question: why fix what wasn't broken? Answer: because if it wasn't broken, it was certainly worn out. Almost as quickly as they had grown, the ratings tanked. As the WCW fan base began to depart in record numbers, the ratings spoke volumes. Audiences were tired of seeing the same old, and they voted with their remote controls. Not only did the ratings collapse, but the all-important pay-per-view buy rates also tumbled, eventually falling right off the cliff. The wrestlers who had supposedly brought the company to its zenith began to quarrel backstage, some choosing to vanish like thieves in the night, rather than shoulder any blame that this was somehow, partially, their own doing. Countless millions were spent on quick fixes that did nothing but drive fans away. Regimes changed backstage. New script writers were brought in. New sets were built. New pay-per-view events were created. Rock and roll bands were brought in to do mini concerts. None of it made a damn bit of difference. All these short-term fixes amounted to little more than putting a bandage on a cancerous tumor. World Championship Wrestling wasn't supposed to die? Right. Part 1. The Birth. Ted called me up and said, "Hey Vince, guess what? I'm in the wrestling business now." Vince McMahon, owner, World Wrestling Entertainment. Chapter 1. 1988 through 1996. Mr. Turner's Baby Boy. While many believed World Championship Wrestling could never die and were stunned in 2001 when it actually did, an even larger group believed the company probably should have died countless times before then, since it had consistently lost so much money. And perhaps it should have. But the misconception that WCW was a huge money loser in its formative years should be dispelled right off the bat. In truth, WCW lost around $6 million per year in the first 5 years of its existence. Not a horrible figure at all, considering what they were giving Turner. 4 hours of excellent ratings every single week of the year. Some within the Turner organization squawked at the losses, but Ted Turner himself didn't. In fact, Turner was such a cheerleader for the company that when his board of directors suggested shutting WCW down in 1992, their argument being that they'd save tons of money putting movies that they already owned in the WCW time slots, he told them that wrestling built the superstation, and as long as he was in charge, it would always have a home there. He also told them never to bring the idea up again. They didn't. Since Turner was so strongly behind WCW, it seemed that regardless of what happened or how much money the company lost, it would always be around. No matter what, no matter how bad things could get, many within the company were unafraid. And unfortunately, this sense of security often led those in charge to make bad decisions. They would throw away money, alienate their employees, and even their fans. None of it mattered, as Ted Turner would always be there to bail them out of a jam. For all of the reasons why the company could have, and arguably should have, died, it did have history on its side. After all, this was a company that had been around almost 100 years, or at least that's one of the myths rabid WCW supporters would have you believe. The truth is a bit different. When promoter Big Jim Crockett died in 1973, his assets, including Jim Crockett Promotions, which ran pro wrestling shows, were eventually passed on to his son, Jim Jr. For decades, the Crocketts, like other National Wrestling Alliance promoters nationwide, tried to bring prestige to their organization by claiming that their main title, the World Heavyweight Championship, dated back to 1905. Their champ, they claimed, wore a belt with a lineage that could be traced to such turn-of-the-century legends as George Hackenschmidt and Frank A. Gotch. Truth be told, the NWA that helped form WCW has roots in 1905 about as much as the rap group NWA does. The confusion stems from the fact that there were two different NWAs, the turn-of-the-century National Wrestling Association and the modern-day National Wrestling Alliance. Today's NWA was formed in 1948 by six promoters at a meeting in Waterloo, Iowa. They named Des Moines promoter Pinky George the first president and Kansas City promoter Orville Brown the first champion. Luthez won the title in 1949, then won the National Wrestling Association title in 1950. Because the group controlled all the major titles, the NWA Championship became the most prominent belt in the world for almost 40 years. In April of 1984, it was one of three big titles in the U.S., along with the world titles of the AWA, promoted by Vern Gagne, and the WWF, promoted by another junior, Vincent Kennedy McMahon. The original Vince McMahon, Vincent James McMahon to be precise, was the son of boxing and wrestling promoter Jess McMahon. Vince Sr. had promoted the Worldwide Wrestling Federation. They dropped a W in 1979. Since 1963, running throughout the Northeast. The highly successful promotion, based in Madison Square Garden, was built around such legendary stars as Bruno Sammartino, superstar Billy Graham, and Bob Backlund. But Vince Sr. was getting old, and his son, the handsome, fast-talking announcer on his wrestling shows, was eager to make a serious impact. Vince Sr. wasn't so sure about his son. He never wanted him to be a wrestler, and probably didn't want him to be involved much with the business at all. Plus, the young McMahon seemed to have some pretty grandiose ideas. Wrestling had always been a territorial business, with different groups promoting cards exclusively in their areas of the country. There was Roy Welch in Alabama, Nick Gulas in Nashville, Leroy McGurk in Oklahoma, and Sam Muchnick in St. Louis, among over 2 dozen others. While promoters would sometimes venture into opposing territories, No one had ever attempted to do what Vince Jr. was planning on such a massive scale. Vince Jr. wanted to promote wrestling wherever he pleased. Amazingly, had Vince Sr.'s wish that his son never become a wrestler come to pass, the history of wrestling might forever be different. A key turning point in the war between WCW and the WWF was Steve Austin's blood feud with his most famous in-ring rival, none other than Vince McMahon himself. Vince was a great heel. His chemistry with Austin was a large part of what turned the tide. While his early stint as a babyface cheerleading announcer was little to pay attention to, and his later stint as a song and dance man, crooning a ditty called Stand Back, was more something for folks to laugh at, the evil Mr. McMahon's pumped-up, faux pro wrestler persona was one to whom nearly every fan could relate. After all, who hasn't had a boss they wanted to pummel? No doubt Austin would have been a huge star regardless, but no one can argue the impact that the vile Mr. McMahon foil had on Austin's rise to fame. And that rise to fame was what gave wrestling fans options, options that led in part to WCW's fall. Contrary to what many believe, Vince Jr. wasn't the first wrestling promoter to go national. His father's Madison Square Garden cards aired regionally on the MSG network and nationally on HBO in the early to mid-70s. Other promotions had been syndicated nationally as early as the dawn of television in the late 1940s, while others, such as Jim Barnett, tried national expansion in the 60s and 70s. And when Ted Turner's Atlanta WTCG UHF station went up on satellite as the Superstation in 1976, it took Jim Barnett's Georgia-based promotion nationwide, airing two shows on the weekends, Georgia Championship Wrestling on Saturday nights, a 6.4 average rating, and Best of Georgia Championship Wrestling, a 6.6 average rating, the following evening. The station quickly grew to serve 15 million people, and the wrestling show was the first program to draw over 1 million viewers on the station, and the first TV show in history to ever reach 1 million homes on cable television. The NWA promoters were leery of this newly configured nationwide coverage, but Vince Sr. argued that it would be ridiculous for him to stop promoting in the Garden. As long as he promoted there, MSG Network was going to broadcast the shows regionally and nationally through HBO, and Barnett simply said that no matter what, his show still featured mainly Georgia wrestlers. Several years later, however, Turner requested that the name be modified to something less regional in scope, and therefore the show was changed from Georgia Championship Wrestling to World Championship Wrestling, which just so happened to be the name of a promotion Barnett had successfully promoted in Australia a decade earlier. Cable, Barnett would later say, could not be stopped. And he was right. In 1982, Vince Sr. finally caved and sold the World Wrestling Federation to his son. The deal, though, was that if Vince Jr. missed even one of his quarterly payments, he'd lose the promotion back to Vince Sr.'s three original partners, Bob Gorilla Monsoon Morella, who eventually got a lifetime announcing gig out of it, Phil Zacco, and Arnold Scotland. While some believe that Vince Sr. was never aware of his son's lofty plans, most with knowledge of the situation feel otherwise. The sense was that even if Vince Sr. did know, he didn't believe that his son could pull it off. Shortly after selling the company, Vince Sr. was diagnosed with cancer, and he died a few months later. Those who doubted Vince Jr. couldn't have been more wrong. Not only did he take the WWF National, he created a near monopoly for himself within 5 years of doing so. One of his first major offensive moves was to offer lucrative contracts to stars, and sometimes guys nobody in their right mind would consider star material, from other territories, most notably from Vern Gagne's AWA. Vince had already offered to buy Gagne's promotion outright, but he'd been shot down. His next step, therefore, was to buy Gagne's talent, including his hottest star of all, a young, bleached blonde muscle man named Hulk Hogan. Hogan ended up being the chosen one, and McMahon quickly moved his WWF title from his father's long-term champion Bob Backlund to the dastardly Iron Sheik. On January 23, 1984, just 28 days later, Hogan beat Sheik in Madison Square Garden with his dreaded leg drop of doom, and Hulkamania took off. Widespread TV was the next major step. In those days, many wrestling promoters got along swimmingly with their local TV affiliates. In many territories, the television people would air the programming for free and make money off the advertising. The wrestling people, meanwhile, would write shows to compel fans to go to the local arena and pay for tickets. In some territories, Jerry Jarrett's Memphis is a good example, the TV stations would actually pay the promoters for the programming. Vince Jr. went from territory to territory, and not only offered the station managers his slick TV tapes in place of their current, often poorly filmed local wrestling shows, but also offered to pay to get them on the air. Further into his expansion, McMahon purchased Georgia Championship Wrestling for $750,000 in a deal actually made behind Ole Anderson's back. The company had gone from a money loser under former promoter Jim Barnett, a notoriously lavish spender, who during a money-losing period in 1982 was forced out by his own booker, Anderson, and other shareholders over allegations of embezzlement, to a moneymaker under Anderson. However, the shareholders were disgruntled that they weren't making any money. All of the profits appeared to be going into the pockets of the highly paid Anderson. Two of the shareholders, former legendary grapplers Jack and Gerald Briscoe, talked the other shareholders into banding together to sell a majority of the stock to McMahon. The entire point of the purchase was for McMahon to gain control of the coveted Saturday and Sunday 6:05 p.m. time slots on TBS, adding those time slots to his traditional Monday night time slot on USA Network, which eventually became the home of Monday Night Raw, gave Vince a virtual monopoly on the best television real estate for pro wrestling in the entire country. His plan, obviously, was to replace tapes of the Georgia wrestlers with tapes of his WWF superstars. The problem was that there was a vast in-ring difference between the two products. The Georgia show featured an emphasis on in-ring action with talented workers, and the WWF show featured a bunch of one-sided squash matches that had already aired on the USA Network. Problem: viewers didn't want WWF wrestling. When the switchover took place on Black Saturday, July 14, 1985, over 1,000 fans angrily complained to the superstation. Many asked specifically for, quote, Gordon Solie Wrestling to return, a reference to the legendary GCW announcer. Turner's response was to give Ole Anderson a Saturday 7 o'clock a.m. time slot so that he could start a new company, Championship Wrestling from Georgia Incorporated, which didn't last long. Then the following year, Turner gave Bill Watts' Mid-South Wrestling a one-hour time slot on Sunday and agreed to finance him so that he could compete nationally against McMahon. Vince, who thought his purchase of GCW would give him an exclusive on TBS, was outraged, particularly since he had paid nearly $1 million for the time slots, and Turner gave Watts the new time slot for free. Turner, of course, disagreed, feeling that Vince had reneged on a stipulation in the contract that required him to produce a separate weekly program from an Atlanta studio. If Vince wasn't going to do it, well, someone else would. Thus began the two-decade war between McMahon and Turner. What made things worse for Vince was that Mid-South, a tremendously well-booked and entertaining show, immediately started to destroy all of his WWE programming in the ratings despite the weird time slot and having no promotion whatsoever. At its peak, the show was averaging a 5.2 rating, not only beating McMahon's shows, but also becoming the highest rated show on all of cable television. Turner, who had promised to bankroll Watts, wanted to kick Vince off the station, but couldn't until the contract the two had signed expired. When that day drew near, who should return to the fold but